How does it?
I don't know. It's a mystery.
You will never age for me. Nor fade. Nor die.
Nor you for me.
Goodbye, my love. A thousand times goodbye.
A scene from Shakespeare in Love, one of the many films produced by Harvey Weinstein and Company, and now tainted by the ongoing sex abuse scandal. Some women investors now say they want to take over the Weinstein Company. We'll talk about that later in the show. First, California Assemblyman Raul Bocanegra is facing sexual harassment accusations. Six women told the Los Angeles Times he did things like grope them, kiss them, ask them for dates repeatedly. He is resigning at the end of the current legislative session, which is 10 months from now. Bocanegra is a 46-year-old Democrat. He represents the Northeast San Fernando Valley. Melanie Mason reported this story for the LA Times. She's here now. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. What are the claims from the women against him?
So we spoke to six women who said that they received unwanted advances, whether they're sort of physical touching, repeated asking outs on dates if they were when they were his subordinates at work, things like that. And of course, this comes on the heels of the report we did a couple weeks ago of another woman who had actually filed a complaint in 2009 saying that he had inappropriately touched her. So now I think the totality is we have seven women who have now come out and say that they've had such experiences with him.
And in that latter case from 2009, didn't the legislature discipline him?
They did. So he was a chief of staff at the time. He wasn't an assemblyman. And so this was an incident that involved a fellow legislative staffer. And he was disciplined. We know this because she has a letter from the Assembly Rules Committee, which sort of functions as the Human Resources Department, saying that he was no longer able to have any communications with her for work purposes. But the truth is that the public didn't have any idea about these claims because the Assembly doesn't disclose this information publicly. They say these are personnel files, and so therefore they're not accessible to the public. So until this woman named Elise Jara decided to speak out 8 years later, this wasn't something that was known to the public.
Hmm. Okay, and so a number of these incidents also happened in the same place in a bar called Mix.
Right, which is a bar a couple of blocks from the Capitol. There's the Sacramento social scene is very small and insular, particularly when it comes to the Capitol crowd. So there's really a couple of bars and lounges and nightclubs where people tend to have after work events, whether they're fundraising receptions or lobbying receptions. And Mix is certainly a very common one. It's also the one that sort of takes on a lot of kind of a clubbier vibe the later the night goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these some of these stories that we've heard involve alcohol, people dancing. And so I think that the vibe is less kind of after work mixer and turns a little bit more into a nightclub.
Oh, okay. And so what does Bocanegra have to say about all this?
So he came out with a statement yesterday that said that he is, as you said, deciding to resign at the end of legislative action next year. So that's not until September. He basically said that there's a lot of persistent speculation and rumor, and that that's not something that he wants to go through and that he wants his constituents to have to go through. He had originally indicated to us with regards to the 2009 complaint, he said that that was an incident that he learned from and that he deeply regretted. And of course, I think that what was powerful about the follow-up story that we did was that almost all of these incidents happened after that fact. So I think that the question was, what did he learn if these allegations are indeed true, and how it appears that he did not change his behavior according to the allegations of these women.
Mm-hmm. Well, could something happen to him? Like, could he be kicked out of the assembly before September 1st or anything else?
So that's what's kind of the speculation mill is in high gear now. So the assembly speaker, Anthony Rendon, put out a statement saying that these allegations were extremely disturbing, and he's launching an investigation into them. And he said that if these allegations, after that investigation, prove to be credible, that he will move to expel Assemblyman Bocanegra. And so the threshold for expulsion is a two-thirds vote of the assembly. So that's 54 votes. Democrats do hold a supermajority, so all of his colleagues could decide to to make that vote. I'm assuming that some Republicans would want to join in as well. But I think a lot of this, quite frankly, depends on the next couple days and weeks. There have been other Democrats who've come out and said the Assemblyman Bocanegra needs to resign now. He can't wait 10 months. And so I think that the question is if he keeps hearing this quite a bit from his own colleagues, does he really want to put himself through what could be an expulsion process should these allegations prove to be founded?
Right. And then there's State Senator Tony Mendoza, also under investigation. And a lot of women have come forward to say that there is just a toxic culture in Sacramento. Do you expect more lawmakers to be accused?
I think that that is certainly something that we are looking into. I think that there's sort of two tracks that are going on right now. There's this meta conversation about the culture of Sacramento and what it is that encourages this kind of behavior on a sort of abstract level, and what it is about the reporting procedures that maybe are discouraging women from going forward and going through formal channels. And then at the same time, there is this question of, are there individual bad actors that people should know about? And so you have seen these stories about Assemblyman Bocanegra and State Senator Mendoza. Obviously, if there are more of these individuals, we'd want to report that out. But we also understand in the media that these are serious allegations and that we're not going to run on rumor or on thinly sourced stories. I mean, these stories take a lot of time because we understand the consequences behind them.
Melanie Mason covers state government and politics for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Meanwhile, in Hollywood, some female investors want to turn the Weinstein Company into a force for good in the fight against sexual abuse. The movie studio has taken a huge financial hit since assault and harassment allegations came out against its co-founder, Harvey Weinstein. Now it's looking for a buyer, and at least two female-led investor groups are in the running. They both want to use the company's movie and TV revenue to help victims. Anna Oliveira is one of the women involved in the bidding. She's president and CEO of the New York Women Foundation. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And also joining us, Cynthia Littleton, managing editor of television for Variety, and she's been covering this sale. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
Anna, let's begin with you. Your organization is partially backing Killer Content, and Killer wants to buy some of the Weinstein Company film and TV projects. What does it want exactly?
The proposition is to look at some of the Weinstein Company's assets. And the ones that are aligned with visions of equality, of respect, of dignity for human beings, women and men alike, and use them to transform. You know, we're really looking for a transformation, not just a change, but a transformation of those assets into healing the harm that the company has been invested in causing. And would use the profits of such assets in the future to fund and support women and men across the country who are struggling to change behavioral norms, cultural norms, policies, to really change this idea that sexual abuse, sexual harassment are acceptable.
And Cynthia, can you talk a little bit more about what the Weinstein Company has in terms of assets and what possibly could fit that criteria?
Well, they have, you know, they have a pretty sizable film library. They've been in business since 2005, and they've been, until recently, they were pretty prolific in releasing independent films. It's not a marquee library with a lot of well-known titles, but they have movies that, you know, people have heard of, like The King's Speech and The Artist and The Imitation Game, you know, a fair number of recent prestige titles. They also have had, in the last 5 years or so, they've really stepped up their activity in television. They have the show that now airs on Lifetime, Project Runway, the fashion design competition. That's been a franchise for them for a long time, and that is one of their most valuable ongoing assets.
And Anna, would that fit your criteria, Project Runway?
Yeah, yes, they would. Yes. I mean, those are types of assets that would be aligned with the values that we are seeking to propagate. The funds, the resources would go, for instance, to organizations. It could be an association of workers. It could be a community-based organization. It could be a policy change organization. We would also support individuals that need the financial support, the legal access, the communication support to be able to come forth.
And so would you also want to make money for killer content? Would that also be part of it? Or is this all nonprofit?
No, this is not about a profitable venture. This is about a social good.
And Cynthia, there are also other groups making offers on the Weinstein Company. And there's another investor group in particular making a similar bid led by Maria Contreras-Sweet. She was in the Small Business Administration under President Barack Obama. Tell us about that.
That one is also, I think it has similar, I think the motivation is similar. I think the construct of that deal is a little different, although from what I understand, Contreras-Sweet has assembled a prominent group of female entrepreneurs and investors, you know, high net worth individuals that would be, again, looking at this not as an opportunity to wring money out of a film and TV library, but to, as Anna said, in a way sort of redeem properties that may, through their association with the Weinstein Company, may, you know, might have a hard time airing on television, being licensed by Netflix or Hulu or any of the platforms that are making so much money for people that own film and TV content. The tarnish has been so severe and so swift that there's genuine, you know, companies are recoiling from the Weinstein Company, pulling their title cards. It's a real concern. So the idea would be, I think, similar, that they would buy this company. People, you know, behind the scenes would know that it would be, you know, a company now owned by female investors. Bob Weinstein and Harvey Weinstein, the principals of the Weinstein Co., would not be profiting. And so take a movie like The King's Speech, which, you know, was a terrific movie that was very well loved, would not sort of be tainted by the lingering association with Weinstein, because people that cared enough to know would know that it was now part of an effort that was making money for an altruistic approach to dealing with the legacy, the unfortunate legacy of what the company co-founder is accused of doing.
And would it simply be taking existing properties and trying to resell them, rebrand them, if you will, or would there actually be new content created under this new company?
Well, right now at the Weinstein Company, like any film and television company, there's always, you know, dozens of projects that are in the works, in the very, you know, very germinal stages. It's such a long road for any movie to go before the cameras. So there's quite a bit of intellectual property, books optioned, articles optioned, that are in various stages of development. In the case of killer films and killer content, the appeal there is that you have well-established, at Killer Films is headed by a woman named Christine Vachon, who is renowned in the independent film world, and she's definitely a female pioneer. She's been very well regarded, and so they could take that development and really manage it, and, you know, bring it along as warranted or as they saw opportunities. I don't know if the Contreras group quite has that same skill set. So that's an interesting example of what Killer could do. And again, as I understand, the thinking is anything that came from Weinstein would be put through this sort of filter of profits and proceeds would flow into the New York Women's Foundation, which would then administer it to various groups on the ground that they saw as worthy.
And do the Weinsteins have any say over how their company is sold?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, of course, the two brothers that founded it have, you know, have just a little over 40% stake, but the company is not in great shape. Even before all of this allegations came out in early October, the company has been known to have been in some pretty dire financial straits. They have a very high level of debt. They have borrowed against their assets. So it's a very messy process that they're trying to sort out. And they were, you know, by all accounts, looking for new investors at the time all of this, you know, all of this horrible news exploded, which basically meant, you know, torpedoed any effort to bring in new investors.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Anna Oliveira. She's president and CEO of the New York Women's Foundation. Also joining us, Cynthia Littleton, managing editor of TV for Variety. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how to survive trauma and come out of it a better person. Rabbi Steve Leder of Wilshire Boulevard Temple is here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. As the leader of LA's mega synagogue, Wilshire Boulevard Temple, Rabbi Steve Leder thought he knew a lot about pain and suffering. He had counseled hundreds of people who were suffering. Maybe they were going through a divorce, or their mother died, or their child was deathly ill. But it wasn't until he suffered a life-changing injury himself that he began to discover how pain changes our lives and can, according to Rabbi Leder, change us for the better. His forthcoming book is called More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. And Rabbi Steve Leder joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
So just to be clear, you're saying something disastrous is not necessary to leading a fulfilling, better life that is more beautiful than before.
I wouldn't put it quite like that. I would say that the suffering we endure is, I'm not for a moment suggesting that it's worth the price of the insights that we achieve as a result. But neither is it worthless. In my experience, it's really, more than anything else, it's pain that encourages people to really make changes in their lives. Success, frankly, doesn't encourage much change. It just encourages more of the same. It's really only pain that propels us to new heights after we plummet to new depths. You know, this is not some attempt in this book to glorify suffering. You know, a friend of mine who had cancer three times and beat it twice when he was dying from this third type of cancer, I visited him in the hospital. He looked at me and said, this much character I don't need. So I'm not suggesting that it's worth it. You know, I say in the book that everyone goes through hell, but you don't have to walk out empty-handed. Suffering can transform your life in ways that frankly enhances it and makes it more beautiful. I know it did for me.
So you write that you don't really become an adult until you suffer.
I think that's right.
Go through that.
Yes. And sometimes that means you become an adult at 5 years old.
But what does that mean, becoming an adult?
I think it means that you have an affinity for others who suffer, that you become less narcissistic, less self-absorbed, more compassionate. In an odd sort of way, more whole in the breaking.
And you can't do that if you haven't gone through some pain, enormous pain?
Well, enormous is relative given each person's perspective. But frankly, no, I don't think you can. I think there are lessons that only pain can teach us. Why pain is valuable.
Let's talk about your particular experience.
Yeah.
So you talk about, the Herculean effort you had to undertake to raise all this money to rebuild the temple.
And right.
Huge
yeah.
deal.
Yeah.
Hundreds
yeah.
of millions of dollars, correct?
By the time we're done, it'll be about $200 million. And my back blew out at about $150 million. And it wasn't just the raising of money, which is its own kind of extremely hard work and occasionally degrading work, because there's a fine line between fundraising and begging. But also just running an enormous institution, you know, with three campuses and lots of people who need taking care of. And, of course, also being a father and a husband. And at a certain point, I had this terrible, terrible pain in my lower back that essentially made it impossible for me to walk. And I think that at a certain point, there's this moment where you realize that you are on the decline, that you're on the back end of the curve. And that's a frightening thing for men who define themselves by their accomplishments. So for me, it wasn't until I experienced this excruciating, paralyzing pain and the depression and the opioids that followed that I really developed some sensitivity for people who suffer beyond what I consider to be an ordinary level of sensitivity. You know, there's this beautiful little teaching that I mention in the book, which is a question really, you know, why does the Bible say that God puts God's words upon our heart? why doesn't God place them in our heart? And the answer the sages give is that it's not until the heart is broken that the words can enter.
So you didn't feel that you had learned that lesson until you suffered this?
Oh, I thought I had. Of course, I thought I was a very compassionate, sensitive, understanding person. And perhaps by many standards, I was. But I reached new levels of sensitivity and compassion that I never would have reached without my own pain and suffering.
So you were initially in denial and tried to work through it.
Yes.
And angry.
Very. Yes. And depressed.
As you mentioned, you went on opioids. Did you become addicted to them?
Well, I know this. I was extremely depressed. And when I they kind of stopped working. And so I would take more. I was able to just stop. And, you know, I was sick for a couple of weeks. So clinically, I would
have to
say
withdrawal.
It probably was. Yeah, I withdrew from them. You know, there was this making peace, I think, for me with the limitations of my body that helped me to begin healing. You know, I tell this story in the book, which seems like a very first world problem, but it's a metaphor, really. After several weeks of recovery, I could, you know, really barely move, but I was able to walk out into my backyard for the first time. Now, I live in a Los Angeles home up in the hills with a very steep hill, right almost, you know, to the back door. And we'd lived in this home for about 10 years before this happened. And I had spent those 10 years at war with the weeds on this back hill. I had everything in the arsenal. I had, you know, machetes and rakes and shovels and, you know, chainsaw, chemicals, everything. I was at war because I wanted this perfect carpet of green ivy on my back hill, you know, an OCD level of perfect greenery. And then, of course, when I had the car accident and then the back surgery and the opioids and everything else, for months I didn't touch that back hill. And then I stumble out to the backyard for the first time to just lie down in the sun and try and get warm and heal a little bit. And I open my eyes out of this kind of post-narcotic and steroidal haze, and I see thousands of gangly weeds, you know, just carpeting and falling all over that back hill. And I thought to myself, a final insult to my infirmity. And then I noticed there was a whole flock of these tiny little yellow birds flitting all over these weeds. These weeds had clearly attracted these beautiful, tiny, flitting yellow birds. And those little yellow birds tweeted and kept me company that entire fall as I tried to heal. And the original title for this book, it didn't start out as More Beautiful Than Before. It started out as Weeds Bring Yellow Birds. Hmm. You know, that in our breaking, there is wholeness. And that if we can create the space in our lives to recognize and make peace with our pain, beautiful things start to emerge.
Are the weeds still there?
No.
So you have not learned your lesson.
But I am not at war with them. My wife, you know, for 10 years uttered the phrase that I imagine many, many wives have uttered for thousands of years, which was, you know, we could hire someone to do that. So part of my healing process was I decided I really can't do everything. And, you know, these weeds, again, it's a very first world problem, but you know, for me, it was an important metaphor that you need to let go of a lot of things in order to find some peace. And only pain can help us in the letting go.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Steve Leader about his new book. It's called More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. You are the rabbi at Wilshire Boulevard Temple, and you write about two families. And both of these families were involved in accidents, but they had radically different outcomes. I wonder if you could talk about that and how the two perpetrators reacted differently.
Yeah, this was one of the most powerful, moving experiences of my life. So within the same year, I had two families in my congregation have loved ones die as pedestrians. In the first case, hit and run, the person who killed this, you know, beautiful 25-year-old young man, took off, never to be seen again, until some very, very diligent police work and the work of his friends and family, finally located the perpetrator. In the second case, the woman who hit this 80-year-old man in the crosswalk because she was reaching for her cell phone, which had fallen off the center console onto the floor, and how many of us haven't done that? Mm-hmm. She stopped. She got out. She did everything she could. There was a criminal and civil case. She did her community service time. She took it seriously. She goes around to high schools and other places and talks about the dangers of texting and cell phone use and driving. She did what she could. Now, here's what's so dramatic. I was at the sentencing hearing for the woman who committed the hit-and-run accident and the father of the young man who died read what this woman said to her husband when she was in the interrogation room and thought the police weren't listening, which was, lie. Don't say anything. Just lie. A complete denial of responsibility. This period caused so much horrible suffering for this family. In the second case, this woman who had done everything she could to make it right called the widow and son of the man she had killed in the crosswalk, who happened to be members of my congregation. So I get this phone call. Rabbi, the woman who killed my husband has asked if she could see me to apologize. Do I have to see her? I said, you do. She said, will you be with me? And I said, I will. And then the meeting took place. It took place in my office. The woman walked in just so thin and frail and, you know, frightened. And by the way, the wife of the man who was killed was a Holocaust survivor, so she had seen some things in her life. So the woman who was driving begins by saying, I'm so sorry. I've done everything I can. I can never bring him back for you. Please, please forgive me. I was wrong. And when she said those words, I was wrong, I felt the barometric pressure in the room change. And this widow's son said to the woman who was driving the car that terrible day, and her son was in the car when this happened, he said, I just have a question for you. How's your son? He seemed so frightened that day. And we all started crying. And then this man's widow stood up and walked over to this woman, and she stood up. She cupped her face in her hands. She held her face. This elderly woman just held her and looked at her weeping. And she said, God bless you. And they embraced.
Wow.
And we were all just, you know, flooded with tears. And I talk in the book about the difference between just lie and I was wrong. I was wrong in almost every situation immediately addresses the pain. It's a much higher degree of culpability than I'm sorry.
And why is that? Because you can be truly sorry. I'm very, very sorry. And
yes, but that can often be interpreted more as I'm sorry that happened or this happened, as opposed to I am the reason this happened. I accept responsibility for this. I was wrong. I was wrong often changes everything.
Why is it so hard for us to say those three words, I was wrong?
Well, we live in a society that often punishes people for saying those things. You know, doctors would apologize for their mistakes if they weren't afraid of being sued. You know, the reason most people don't want to sue their doctors. They want them to own the mistake.
Right. But why can't we say that just between you and me?
Because in our culture, there's no longer just between you and me. We punish people for their mistakes. We pull old grudges off the shelf and hurl them at the people we claim to love the most. And that's a terribly dysfunctional situation. And it is a missed opportunity to take the pain and transform it into a more loving relationship. Pain is an opportunity. Pain is always an opportunity. Now, again, that doesn't mean that we're glad it happened. You know, I've had women whose husbands have had affairs tell me that the knowledge of that affair led to the first honest, deep conversation the two of them have had in years and resulted in a second marriage within their first marriage. I have also had women whose husbands had affairs and betrayed them say to me, you know, we're still together, but it would have been a lot better if it never happened. I'll never be over it. It can go either way, and it really depends on this capacity to own it and forgive it.
What's harder, the owning or the forgiving?
I think the forgiving. It's also the most liberating.
I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Rabbi Steve Leder. His new book is called More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. Coming up, the fight over net neutrality is reignited when the head of the FCC says he wants to get rid of it. And in our internet age, we don't communicate the way we used to. One editor wants to get rid of a certain word entirely.
Whom is, it's kind of pretentious, and I do feel like people tend to use it incorrectly, and we can just avoid that whole situation if we obliterate it entirely.
New grammar rules for a new world next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Federal Communications Commission says it is planning to do away with net neutrality. FCC Chair Ajit Pai says the federal government will stop micromanaging the internet. And yesterday, the Justice Department announced it is suing to stop AT&T's $85 billion bid to buy Time Warner. The government says that merger would harm competition. Janet Guyon is technology editor at Quartz. She's here to talk about both those stories. And Janet, let's begin with the net neutrality news. Ajit Pai says this administration wants to get rid of these rules because it'll make competition better. What does that mean in practice for you and me when we use the internet?
Well, in practice, it may mean that you're going to pay more money if you use the internet a lot. One of the aspects of this is heavy users of the internet, say you watch Netflix all day long, you should have a fast lane to get that service, and for that fast lane, you might need to pay more money. I mean, right now, most people get their internet service, they have the same charge every month, and everybody in the area that you live in pays the same amount of money. But if you use the internet a lot more than somebody else, maybe you should pay more. And that's kind of the heart of net neutrality. It's the idea that everybody should have equal and open access and at the same price. So I think that this doing away with these particular rules and exactly how they're going to do that is not quite clear, is sort of the ability for people to pay for what they use.
Doesn't it also mean that certain companies, bigger companies, would have access to faster access times? In other words, it would be easier to access something that from Netflix than from some smaller company?
Yeah, possibly. It does introduce into what we have grown up with on the internet a pricing structure that's disparate for different people and for different companies. So if Netflix wants to get distribution for their movies, they may have to pay more. And that means maybe your $99 a month fee or whatever you're paying may go up if you're a heavy user of Netflix. So, you know, it just changes the pricing structure, and both for consumers and for companies, depending on how heavily they use the web.
So a court has ruled in favor of these net neutrality rules. So does that mean consumer groups are going to sue to prevent any of these changes now?
It looks like it's just going to be a big court fight. Mm-hmm. And there will be suits on different sizes, on different sides, with everybody saying we're going to go to the Supreme Court and trying to throw it back to Congress. I mean, unfortunately, the web has sort of grown up in this kind of Wild West era where everybody just makes their arguments and then everybody settles down for a while and says, well, I guess we won't be fighting with each other for a while. But Congress has not stepped in since the 90s in terms of how to regulate or how to provide an open access for the web for everybody. I mean, one of the issues in this is, you know, what happens to people in disadvantaged places or rural places? The internet has become basically an essential service for almost everything that we do, including education.
Mm-hmm. Right. And not just in rural areas, everywhere. It seems to be an essential tool. Okay, let's turn to this AT&T deal very quickly. The Justice Department is opposing it. And some people are saying, well, this is because Donald Trump doesn't like CNN. Is there anything to that?
Well, Donald Trump obviously does not like CNN.
Yeah.
So, and he did say during the campaign that he wanted to block this merger. So, you know, how much his fight with CNN has to do with this is really not clear. You know, the Justice Department is denying that, and the head of AT&T raised that as a possible issue. Their argument is it's a vertical integration with content providers and the people who, you know, bring wires into your house, and it gives AT&T too much power to own, you know, the rights to the Game of Thrones and your television service and your internet service. So that's the argument that the Justice Department is making. I'm sure that CNN will come up as a politicized football in this fight, because again, we've got two sides saying that they are going to fight one another. So I'm sure AT&T will come up. But the one thing you have to ask yourself is, will AT&T be better off? Will CNN be better off being part of this big conglomerate called AT&T, or is it better off on its own? So you have to kind of think about that a little bit when you get into that argument.
Interesting that AT&T would probably benefit from getting rid of net neutrality, but not from this particular move in the other portion.
Exactly. It's there. The government is kind of on two sides with them, isn't it?
Yeah. Janet Guyon, technology editor at Quartz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Oxford commas in, the word whom out, new grammar rules for a Twitter world next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When it comes to writing, there are lots of rules, or at least there were lots of rules. You probably have the elements of style somewhere in your house or office. Well, now with social media, the internet, and emojis everywhere, these rules have really broken down. Is there one correct way to write anymore? Emmy Favilla says no. She is former global copy chief for BuzzFeed, and her new book is called A World Without Whom: The Essential Guide to Language in the BuzzFeed Age. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. Well, let's begin with your title and whom. I know a lot of people are saying, now, hang on a second. I know it's hard to remember when to say who and whom, but we shouldn't get rid of it, right?
Well, the thing is, whom is, it's kind of pretentious, and I do feel like people tend to use it incorrectly, and we can just avoid that whole situation if we obliterated entirely.
So when you say to who I'm talking about, that's okay?
All right. I'll concede that sounds a little awkward, but I think maybe in a few years or a few decades, if we start the trend now, it might not sound as unnatural and awkward to us.
Right. Okay. So you are a fan of fluidity when it comes to these roles. You're not saying we have to do it this way because this is the rule.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I also think that it largely depends on the medium and, of course, the rules that we are adhering to in text message or a GChat with someone are going to be wildly different from a piece of published journalism or a novel. And I really think that is also the approach that editors need to take as well. I'm a big fan of fluidity and using your heart. That's I say to follow your heart is, if you read the book, it's a main thread throughout the book.
However, you don't want to look like an uneducated rube who doesn't know how to spell or doesn't know the basics of grammar. I mean, you still should have some subject-verb agreement, correct? Like, that's one rule that I wouldn't want to see go by the wayside.
Absolutely. There are some hard and fast rules that will always apply, but I see the number of those rules dwindling as technology influences our modes of communication, and things like the line break wind up leading us to not needing periods at the end of sentences.
Well, right. I was just going to ask you that. Some people are saying get rid of the period entirely.
Periods, I would say, are the most essential punctuation mark that we have. We need it to distinguish where one sentence ends and another begins. But I do think that thanks to the line break and the fact that we're sending things off piecemeal in text messages, in GChats, direct messages, things of that nature, one-line emails, there isn't as much of a need to add end punctuation to our sentences if we're just sending them off one sentence at a time. And as a result of that, I think for millennials especially, it's really strange that the period is such a loaded punctuation mark now. But again, it's largely due to the fact that we're sending things off piecemeal one by one, sentence-wise.
Yeah. How do you feel about ellipses?
I'm okay with ellipses. I think overuse of ellipses can come off as a little creepy.
Because you don't know what's next. It's like,
you don't know what's next. In horror movies, you always see letters written in blood with ellipses at the end, you know, to appear kind of spooky and mysterious. We need to watch it with the overuse there. But I'm not opposed to ellipses. I will say that I think it's really important if you are a professional writer and you're quoting someone, for the sake of saving space, not to butcher their quotes and throw in a bunch of ellipses, because that can also send the message to the reader that you were maybe manipulating their quote and trying to massage it into something, you know, to convey an intended meaning that was not their original one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important in the world of professional journalism. But, you know, in terms of casual everyday writing, they're a little emo, but I don't have anything necessarily, you know, against them.
Okay. You have a chapter in your book called How to Not Be a Jerk. And in it, you have sensitive subjects. And I guess you're writing to your writers at BuzzFeed as to how they should talk about these topics of journalistic interest, like immigration or gay rights, adoption, abortion. And look, I just made a mistake. I should have said same-sex rights, right?
Yes. Yes.
That is one of the things that I am learning reading your book. So can you go over some of these? Maybe you should just go over the difference between gay marriage and same-sex marriage.
Same-sex marriage is preferred to gay marriage because we don't necessarily want to assume someone's sexual orientation based on the fact that they are the same sex. They may both identify as male, but that doesn't necessarily mean that both parties are gay. They may identify as bisexual or you know, plenty of other sexual orientation identities. And by using same-sex marriage and same-sex rights, we're not making any assumptions.
Okay, good point there. And then talking about immigration, you say that BuzzFeed uses undocumented immigrant, and then that's not what AP Style uses?
There was a lot of back and forth between this, but we ultimately settled on a ruling contrary to the AP Style book because we felt like the people who we are speaking about when we were talking about undocumented immigrants actually use that language to self-describe. To a bigger point, a lot of thought goes into the entries in the BuzzFeed Style Guide. It's not just me or my team of copy editors sitting around for about 5 or 10 minutes and then throwing a rule in the style guide. There is back and forth conversation. There are email threads. There is IRL conversations in real life.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Anyone not familiar with the acronym?
All right. So do you have any pet peeves, though, when it comes to writing and maybe the way people are now expressing themselves?
I will say that the only thing that I might be a bit of a stickler about is consistency in terms of of style and words spelled throughout one piece, so it's cohesive and it's not distracting, and you're not pulling the reader out of immersion. And they're saying, "Well, was this style this way before, and now it's
so." If you're going to make a mistake, just own it and keep doing it.
I think that's solid advice. And I'm also kind of a stickler about making sure to not put a hyphen after an adverb, because an adverb by definition modifies the word it precedes. We never need a hyphen after it. And a lot of people will add a hyphen, like say a highly rated book.
Right.
They'll add that hyphen in, but that's actually not necessary.
Is there something political to grammar these days? Because when you see, for example, the president of the United States tweeting, he doesn't necessarily use the best grammar or spelling out there. And that's seen as part of his attraction to his supporters. They're like, he's just, you know, he's just like one of us. He's a regular person. He's not a stickler for these conventions. It says something about who he is politically. And then for his detractors, it says something else entirely. Do you see grammar and punctuation in that light, in a political light at all?
I can see it in a political light, in the sense that not spelling things correctly or using quote-unquote correct grammar, because as we know, there's some margin for fluidity in there. I can see that as being political in terms of giving it a way for people to judge one another, to kind of infer a person's value based on their education.
Yeah. And so by breaking down those barriers, that kind of does that as well. I mean, there's also on the other side the case of, let's say, Black activists who purposefully use, you know, different forms of grammar, different forms of punctuation to make a point.
Yeah. And I think it's also on a bigger point, the internet is such a breeding ground for misappropriating language as well. Like we've seen in the word basic, how that actually has roots in Black culture, and it originally had a meaning more along the lines of uncouth, and people who were not familiar with that meaning saw it and started using it in ways that they thought were most appropriate. And so now it's evolved and transformed into sort of a description of boring conformity. So we see that happening a lot as well.
I wonder if you have the same experience I'm having, or if it's just my brain kind of disintegrating, but I feel like the more I use technology and the more I use autocorrect and things like that, the less able I am to spell as well as I once was. Oh, thank God.
Same. Okay. And I feel like I constantly have to look things up and make sure I'm spelling them correctly. I want to say it's kind of like, you know, when you first discovered a calculator as a kid, you're like, oh, why did I need to memorize all of my multiplication tables? Like,
This is
all here in a piece of technology that I can use to figure this out. Yeah, I also sometimes feel like my brain is disintegrating, even though it's my job to just look at words all day long.
Well, one day the machines will take over and they'll tell us, right?
Yeah.
Or they have already, actually.
Can't wait.
I know. Who's going to write your next book? Not you. Emmy Favilla is BuzzFeed's former copy chief, and she's written a new book. It's called A World Without Whom, The Essential Guide to Language in the BuzzFeed Age. Emmy, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Christian Bordahl, to whom do you refer when you read the listener comments?
I have to admit that sometimes I also, you know, worry about whether I'm using who or whom correctly, and I have to think to myself, wait a minute, I have to turn that around, so I use who or whom.
And it is a bit of a relief to know we don't have to use it anymore.
Don't we have to use it anymore?
Has the rule changed? She says
no.
Get rid of it.
That's it. All right.
World without whom.
Well, another thing that we may be able to get rid of, or maybe got rid of for us, is net neutrality. Because the President Trump's FCC chair, Ajit Pai, says that's out of here. Yes. I like alliteration. Those are the rules that say the internet providers can't charge more for some sites than others or make it more difficult to get to some sites. They have to treat everything neutrally. Mm-hmm. So consumer groups mostly opposed. I've been scanning through. There's a lot of reaction out there on Twitter. But I've yet to find any tweets that support the idea of doing away with net neutrality. Our listener, Cheyenne Fritz, says, shouldn't this be something the public should vote on? No, I'm afraid not. This is something that the FCC can just kind of decide what they're going to do.
The public did vote when they elected Donald Trump, and who campaigned against net neutrality.
Exactly, yes.
So there you go.
Yep. And, you know, Ajit Pai says he's just getting rid of heavy-handed internet regulation, says all the concerns are hysterical prophecies of doom. Anyway, I put up a little Twitter poll asking what people think. You might expect to anticipate what the results are. 87% say this is terrible. 1% say, it's no big deal. 3% say, oh yes, it's a good idea. And 9% say, what's net neutrality again?
I'm in that camp. Okay. Thank you very much, Christian Bordahl. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brandt. I'll see you tomorrow.